and welcome to Fermat Slash Theater's podcast project. My name is David Simmons, and it gives me great pleasure to be in conversation today with Catherine Talbot, a Madison-based poet, musician, and photographer. Her collection, The Little Red Poem, is forthcoming from Dancing Girl Press, and she has published three other chapbooks, Nouned, Verb, from Dancing Girl Press, Freeze-Dried Love, from Finishing Line Press, and St. Celia's Days, from Parallel Press. Catherine was recently nominated for two Pushcart Prizes in poetry. Her verse has appeared in numerous journals and anthologies. A song cycle based on her poetry was premiered in Toronto in May of 2015. She has been poet in residence for Sound Ensemble Wisconsin, and she has collaborated with Theater Leela. She was voted Madison Magazine's Best Spoken Word Artist Poet in 2015. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Tell us about music and poetry, because many of us know you primarily as a musician and not as a poet. So what's the interaction there?
Well, I constantly have a soundtrack in my head, and I'm more often than not practicing or thinking about how I should be practicing my viola. And so that music definitely informs my poetry, as I view poetry as just a little distillation of a moment. Music is perfect food for that, I feel.
And how long have you been writing?
I've been writing since I was 6 years old. I was out under the almond tree in our backyard in Adelaide, South Australia, hammering on my mother's typewriter. And I remember my first poem still, but I will not waste podcast time on that.
Some people also know you from the theater because you have three daughters who are actresses. Can you talk about the theater and how that's influenced your work?
It is almost as strong as the music in terms of feeding my ideas, because I would sit through six King Lears in a row and certainly hear something new every time. And through that process of my sideways brain would be constantly harvesting moments that I'd like to write about or think about for a concept in poetry.
Could you just describe for us your process? I mean, do you sit down consciously with the idea that I'm going to write a poem this morning, or do things spontaneously come to you and you jot them down?
Mostly the first. Mostly I sit down, I have my cats lining up to sit in my lap, and I need that coffee, and I always read poetry before I write it. So usually that's how a poem is produced. I sit down and never, ever know what is coming out. And then I'll read something and stare out the window, my white pines outside or my muse, and usually something arrives, usually a title arrives, and then I bounce off that, and the poem is done.
Who would you say are some of your influences?
Shakespeare, of course, just because he's just been hammered into my head for so many years with my girls doing young Shakespeare players. And I just early on loved the little hooks that Billy Collins puts on the end of his poems, and Mary Oliver, Takes My Breath Away. There are just so many. And very honestly, Wisconsin poets in general completely blow me away. I just cannot believe how many extraordinary poets I'm surrounded by just walking through this town. It's just extraordinary. So they continue to inspire me. I have everybody's books and I read them constantly.
So what do you have for us today?
I brought three sets of poems that sort of reflect parts of my life. I, believe it or not, have a master's in molecular biology. That was what I studied seriously for many, many years, and I worked in a lab. And then photography and music sort of took over when my boss left for New Mexico. And I have retained not the paycheck, but the scientific insights or appreciation into these little moments that happen around us in the scientific world. And they very often end up snagged into my poetry. So would you like me to start reading?
Please.
Okay, great. These, I'm going to read from my science poems, first of all. And as I said, I will either find one in the White Pines, a poetry seed, or else I will have it in the back of my head and revisit it the next morning. But I read this, I think it was probably in a children's book, but I read about this extraordinary woman, Annie Jump Cannon. She lived from 1863 to 1941, and she classified 230,000 stellar bodies and discovered 300 new stars, and she was paid 25 cents a day. So I felt like I had to write a poem to honor her hard work and underrepresentation, and I call it Hot Stars. Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me. You spent all those nights in the Harvard Observatory with your brilliance and that of the stars and Annie Jump Cannon. You lived a destiny bestowed by a naming, an implied duo trajectory off the earth. And so, maybe you didn't get those kisses. Maybe you did. But we can thank you over a century later for your mnemonic O B A F G K M A. The stars more comfortable now with your temperature-dependent classification in their own sultry skins.
That was very lovely.
Thank you. And I'm actually holding this fossil in my hand as I'm going to read this one because I just love it so much. Conversations with a fossil. You and your million years lie obediently in my palm, your tidy spine still there, suspending your death. They've caught and polished you into a long teardrop. I could use you as a spear, bound to strong and slender instincts to pierce my past, break open my frozen sorrows, release the breath I have held over long years, and watch trees struggle with the sudden tempest. But I shan't right now, maybe Wednesday. Today I will line up the dancing pine's reflections alongside your shiny backbone and gasp at the concordance of the new that you can hold forever. And this one that I'm going to read next was when I was leafing through an astronomy book. And I was so excited to be asked by Theatre Lila to present some poems for their series Trash that they made into theater pieces. And this one in particular was just extraordinary for me to watch the process because it was selected by for a dancer and an actor in one body. And he dictated this poem as he interpreted it with a dance that just completely blew me away, especially of the broken heart and how it still beats. It was, I will never forget that movement. So it was such a thrill to work with them. This one is called Supernova Remnant N132D. Maybe that's where my heart is on those dark days, drawn to the expanding remnant of a star explosion. So close to our sorrows, aren't they? A quick dance with hydrogen and oxygen, a tango with what remains when something shatters, a reminder and a rejuvenation, and then back to the heart's task of pulsing, sustaining, before the next unexpected arrive. And this was just walking around a desert in Tucson, and I was just blown away by this big cactus. And I thought of this poem that I wrote later. Life lesson from a dead cactus. Stand tall till the end. Show some strength. Mask the rest under your succulence. Take your time growing strong arms. During hard times, keep roots shallow but extensive, ready to absorb and sustain. Know that darkness is the time to transpire. Let go of your oldest spines as you age, and at the end, peel apart in a slow, arid dance. Reveal your unfathomable thew, and let your ribs echo with a century of fortitude. And I do write very silly poems, too, and these last two are in that category. I did study senescence as an undergrad, and I love that word, the way the leaves fall off the trees. So this one is entitled Senescence, and it was from a walk I took in Owen Park, and I witnessed this very happening, and so I had to write a poem about it. Senescence. Most of them give it up gracefully, a quick float down to close the parentheses. They know the leaf scene, the alarming increase in respiratory rate, a tarantella of O2, CO2, the nasty accumulation of, how do you say, metabolic products, the telltale loss in dry weight, and what leaf has anything to spare these days? But did you happen to see, for God's sakes, that one today with black satin veins and a stiff golden cloak, barrel down, screaming like a Heldon tenor, a veritable rage aria amid the whispers of acquiescence, landing solidly in the middle of the resolute final chord, his leafy libretto still floating behind. A season of life, a life of season. Too magnificent a finale not to pick up the leaf, toss it to the stream, give him a coda, a one last histrionic odyssey to fuss about. And here's one about periodic tables. Periodically. It was today, after I spied on an old periodic table of the elements, the subscript, elements 110 through 111 are not included in this periodic table, because their existence is still being disputed among scientists. That I, in my current state of obliqueness, dreamed of, ached for such attention. Element 110.21. A row of pipe-smoking lab coats pondering my very, as I whistle a sweet little ditty and wink at their horn-rimmed appraisal. So that's my pile of science poems.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I had no idea that you had a science background, and so I've learned something new today.
It's my dirty little secret.
So I see that you also brought some poems about the process of writing. Can you share those with us?
Yeah, I tend to write more than I should of this kind of poem, but they just keep popping up, so I can't bat them away. And the process of writing for me is just, it's a moment of joy every single day when I'm able to sit down and write. When I get that idea or that title, it's just, I wouldn't call it an epiphany, but it's just a little blooming inside me. I'm so grateful it happens. But one day I thought of, maybe I was hungry or something, but this was the title that popped in one morning, and it was called Epiphany Popsicles. Isn't that how it feels, how it tastes? The moment when that idea, image, or passage floats or crashes into your thoughts and lands, and all you want to do is dance across a tightrope, bellow across a canyon, but instead you buckle down and get to work with your pencil and your boomerang. I'm showing my little Australian roots there. And just staring at an open notebook is enough to trigger a poem sometimes. Just holding that blank page, as so many people have for centuries and centuries. This one I call Heft. Remind me to weigh one of these notebooks, these landing strips for my poems, before a single dash of graphite. And then, just before I reach for a fresh one, let me weigh the loaded thoughts, the nonsense and despair, the heart's ballast. And then I'm always writing silly ones about my poems because my lack of self-respect or something. I give my poem a buzz cut. It's the season, prickly heat, bothersome flyaways. The lines are so sloppy, run-on, frizzy, so I moisten it with my lazy tears, comb it with a fishbone, spritz it with essence of succinctness, braid the scraggly lines tenderly. Let the scissors begin their embrace, and let the razor have the final word. And here's the last one in my little pile of silly word poems. The secret life of metaphors. And I remember bringing this to a crit group, and one of my fellow poets was so sad she hadn't written that poem. She loved the title so much, and that was a great compliment, I think. The secret life of metaphors. I imagine most of them live in stables, patiently awaiting the next call to arms, groomed and watered with their literary vaccinations up to date, waiting for the pencil, the poet. And when the moment comes, their clever garb is thrown upon them, buckled, unbridled, and they are led to the track with cheers from the lovely ladies and gents. Most will obediently trot in iambic pentameter around the track, but one or two will spot the broken fence, the straight line, free verse gallop, and with a brilliant leap of faith, land without any hairline line breaks, just where they should.
So I see you also brought some poems about music. Can you share those?
Why, certainly, David, I can. My first collection was called St. Cecilia's Days, and it was how music is woven through my life, and some of these are from that, but most of them are from an upcoming collection that I have to send out called The Devil Orders a Latte. And these are not just about music, but about performance and the preparation for performance and the backstage moments. And this one occurred at a break in a rehearsal for Gounod's Faust with the Madison Opera, and all the leads were standing in front of me, and I was the little violist taking notes in the back, and I wrote this poem called The Devil Orders a Latte. And a piece of crumb cake charms the barista. Faust is indecisive, holds up the line, trying to decide what will serve his needs best. Valentin's order is forgotten as usual, and Marguerite doesn't think twice about ordering that oat fudge bar and whipped cream on the cappuccino because, in the end, she knows she can get away with murder. And a chamber opera we did of Philip Glass's called Galileo Galilei was just a wonderful experience, and this was a backstage moment that I found really hilarious. Galileo after the trial. He passed me like a caffeinated ghost in the hall, his robes brushing against my legs as I sat on a backstage table after scene 4, resting my limbs and eyes between minimalism's maximum challenges to fingers and brain. "You guys sound great," he said in un-Italian as he flowed by. He was texting, or I was, I can't remember, but the absurdity shimmers still in my memory, just before the fifth scene in which he would pen the dialogue concerning the two chief systems of the world, the one that got him in deep shit with the Pope back in scene 2, within the reverse temporal structure of the opera. I swung my pendulum fishnet legs through the final minute before the call for tuning in collegial defense of the Copernicus theory. So that's one silly one. And I hope that some of you listening have heard a countertenor live, because it's one of the most extraordinary experiences a human in a society of expectation can have. Because it's a man singing with the voice of a high angel, and you just don't know quite how to process it. And this one's called The Countertenor and the Platypus. Admit it, you instantly saw the connection, the unexpected combination, the awe of the whole, as he sings the Agnus Dei right through your heart, as she roughs up the basic rules of zoology. He, with the purity of a heaven in his chaste voice of anomaly, she, with her unquestionable furry unity of bill, tail, egg, the way it suddenly seems it ought to be. This came out of an accidental situation I got myself in with sangria. And it's titled, "The Night I Played a Beethoven Sonata Drunk." Well, so was the pianist. We were just reading, screaming with delight at the missed high notes, the unexpected chord progressions, a forgettable reading musically, an unforgettable one dramatically. Act 3 of living, living well, loudly, happily, before the rest of it moves in Act 4. That was the only time I played tipsy. And this is about something that's so critical to so many stages in this town, in this world, and it's about a piano tuner. If you've ever just sat and zenned out on a piano tuner tuning a piano, you'll know what I'm talking about. This is called The Piano Tuner's Beat. It's not anything like the pulse of a body asleep. Bigger, loopier, the way it goes between a solo note, an interval, the hammering, the tightening, repetitive and unpredictable, the way you are in my heart. Until it becomes the pianist's heartbeat, the ragtime bass, Chopin's imperative, Scarlatti's folly. We got two more. And this one I just wrote up at Stratford, Ontario. And it was a moment when I was just feeling so many things at once in a wonderful way. And it was this feeling of rhythm, because it was raining and I saw a boat of paddlers. They were with oars on their knees, like the Hawaiian paddling, not the rowing. And they were paddling with such beautiful rhythm, and I had seen so much Shakespeare, and so it all came together in this poem, in this moment that I wrote down in the poem. Cadence. In that moment, it all made sense. The rhythm of the paddlers, boat of 8 with 2 out that day, like missing teeth. The oars driving a time signature more predictable than the steady raindrop radials on the Avon River, passing the theaters where iambic pentameters reign, where the ear leans towards rhyme while the mind bumps along the lanes of syntax lined with known but startling destinies. I lied. I have two more. And this is talking about the nerves that we all have when we're standing backstage. You know about that, David. You've been on stage.
Briefly.
Briefly. This is called backstaged. The nerves in their massive padded defensive gear are bumping around us in the tiny backstage area. And because they look so awkward following us onto the stage, most of us leave them behind, benched on brocaded cushions of self-doubt. And when we return on the sea of applause, the room is empty, save our open cases and music now expired. And my final one, I think this is, I hate to use terms favorites because I'm a twin and I'm always uncomfortable with she's more and he's more. Anyway, but I think this is one of my favorite, the most favorite poems I've ever written. It just brought me so much joy when I saw this moment on the prairie and put it together with a rehearsal I was having the night before. It's called World Without End, a new translation from the Latin text by a local field mouse. I'm guessing it was the night last week, during those rehearsals of Rossini's Stabat Mater, that the owl dined so well, judging from the scat secrets I found in the prairie. Upon a closer reading, Mother of Sorrows, a delicate signature emerged, a procession of tiny white bones, authenticating the inevitable. So there you have it, some of my poems.
Catherine Talbot, thank you so very, very much. This has been wonderful. And this podcast project is supported in part by grants from the Madison Arts Commission, the Wisconsin Arts Board, and Dane Arts. So again, thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for having me, David, and I'm thrilled to be on this format. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and we should do it again sometime.
All right, I'm in. Thank you.